If you're like me, you have asked yourself many times, why are there so few anti-Soviet movies made by Western filmmakers? Welcome back to another T-Rex Talk. Very likely you have not asked yourself this question, but start thinking about it. It's kind of interesting to me that there are tons and tons and tons of anti-Nazi World War II movies that are made during World War II, unsurprising, because propaganda is a thing. But that is the majority of the war movies that are made by Hollywood during the Cold War. The Cold War is longer, and the victims of the various Soviet Holocausts outnumber those of the Nazi Holocaust, and the potential for global war was higher than even what we experienced during World War II, and yet there's just not a whole lot of movies about the Cold War. Now, there are quite a few movies where the Soviets and the communists and various socialists and Marxists actually are pretty well lionized in these films. Films that are critical of socialism, communism, or even Stalin himself, fairly rare. Now, there are more of them now. There's starting to be a few. Hollywood did make, and a bunch of fairly high-level Hollywood comedians made a film called The Death of Stalin, kind of lampooning what the Soviet Union was like. But this is the sort of film that probably would not have been made even in the 80s when some of that stuff was being criticized by Gorbachev himself. And there's a film called Bitter Harvest about the famines in Ukraine. And now that Russia has invaded Ukraine and everybody in the intelligentsia and the mainstream media has picked sides, we will probably start to see more anti-Russian films that are set during the Soviet Union times. But for most of the Cold War itself, anti-Soviet films, extremely rare. Now, part of the reason for this is something that we have talked about before on the podcast, which was in the 30s, people tried to paint there being only two sides in the 20th century conflicts. You can be either a communist or you can be a fascist. This was particularly in the 1930s, the lead up to World War II. This was the line that was peddled in a lot of academia, but definitely in Hollywood as well. So the Communist Party of Los Angeles, which was founded in 1935, was obviously the Communist Party, but they had a sister organization called the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League. They worked hand in hand and raised money and distributed to various causes back and forth. And a lot of people in Hollywood were very understandably anti-Nazi for entirely good reasons. And they got kind of suckered into this pro-communism flavor. And then there were a bunch of people in Hollywood who were very anti-Nazi merely because they were communists first. And this was a really helpful way to communicate their message. And even today, you see that same old tired party line that says, you have to be opposed to Nazis, even if it means being cozy with communists. Even though that is, of course, hogwash. They are both large totalitarian Marxist regimes, just with slightly different flavors of corporatism. But that is kind of probably the main reason that you end up with very, very few anti-Soviet films being made by Hollywood during the Cold War. In fact, I believe there are more anti-Soviet films being made in communist Poland and the Czech Republic and other places like that than Hollywood. These are people who are risking their careers, certainly, and their lives, maybe, by criticizing the Soviet Union. And in Hollywood, not so much. Now, to clarify, there are some anti-communism movies in a general sort of vague, fuzzy way, or anti-collectivist movies, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers is probably one of the most famous, famously interpreted as an anti-communism movie, because it's sort of anti-collectivism. And it's a little bit fuzzy to actually decide what is anti-communist. A great example of this is The Grapes of Wrath. The Grapes of Wrath, both the book and the film, were heavily criticized in America for being anti-American and anti-capitalism because of the way that it talks about the Great Depression and basically depicts America's capitalistic economy as a failed experiment because of the hardships of the Great Depression. And because of that, there were a lot of groups that spoke out about the film, and Stalin's cultural group said that if America Americans are criticizing this attack on capitalism, we will bring it to the Soviet Union. And the film was released in the Soviet Union, but only for a brief period of time. It was pretty immediately pulled and banned from the Soviet Union as well, because even though this film portrays a hard, cruel, brutal, difficult existence for Americans during the Great Depression, that looked like unbelievable utopia to people in the Soviet Union. The really, really hard, downtrodden American peasants still had cars and refrigerators and telephones and food. And so a lot of Soviet commentators believed that this was American propaganda, something to make America look great and capitalism look more successful than was, you know, technically, physically possible. So defining what is and what isn't propaganda can be a little bit tricky. So let's just narrow our focus on films that very deliberately make the Soviet government or Soviet government agents the antagonist. Let's try to think of some of those. And there's really not that many. There's White Nights, which is the movie that we're going to talk about mostly. There's Red Dawn, obviously. There's The Hunt for Red October, a little bit less overtly, but they're definitely the bad guys. There's Rambo 3, the best of all of the Rambo movies. And we should probably include The Manchurian Candidate. The Red Chinese are the main bad guys, but I think there's a couple of Russian Soviets who show up in that one. And then Hanoi Hilton is another one where you have communist enemies, but primarily the Viet Cong type guys. I'll include that one. And I'm not a film expert. I'm sure there's some movies here and there that I am missing. But for every one of these movies that I've mentioned, there is a movie like the 1981 film Reds, which was directed by Warren Beatty. And this is a film that is just incredibly pro-communism. It is a film about the Russian Revolution and how amazing and how great and how pure and how noble and how full of promise it was. One of the famous lines from the film, someone says, "If you had been to Russia, you would never be cynical about anything again." So, yes. And I'm not even talking about just pretentious art house films from guys who are as confused as Warren Beatty. I'm talking about just generic movies. Like in 1998, there was a film called Red Heat, where Arnold Schwarzenegger plays a good Soviet policeman who comes over to America to help American cops catch Russian criminals. Or are they Russian criminals? They might not even be Russian criminals. But he is definitely a Soviet officer who is one of the good guys. In fact, if we just looked at movies with the name Red in the title, we would probably find way more pro-communist than anti-communist movies, for sure. But let's talk about White Nights, because White Nights is a really fascinating and largely forgotten film that is really good. And it's one of the realest films ever made, which I will explain in a little bit. But it also requires quite a bit of backstory, because if you are listening to the T-Rex Arms podcast, you are probably too young to remember the early 80s and what the Cold War felt like. And you probably don't remember Mikhail Baryshnikov, who was the greatest ballet dancer in the world, possibly of all time. And you also probably don't care, because it's a ballet dancing thing. But Baryshnikov was kind of a big deal, because he was the greatest of all the Soviet ballet dancers in the Bolshoi, and he was one of these people that the Soviet government held up as evidence of their superior culture and their superior way of doing things. Russia made a very big deal out of winning the Olympics all the time, having the best chess players, and of course, having the best ballet dancers. A great proof of communism's superior everythingness, even though this tradition of great Russian ballet dancers, great Russian composers, and great Russian chess players predates communism, and even Marx, I believe. But what makes Baryshnikov really famous and interesting is that he famously defected from the Soviet Union to the United States. He managed to escape from his KGB handlers when he was in Canada and made it to America, land of freedom, and continued to be the greatest ballet dancer in the world. And he was no longer a great triumph for the Soviet Union, he was a great triumph for American capitalism. Although the kind of people who love ballet and ballet dancers weren't really wanting to rub the Soviet Union's nose in this quite as much. So it's kind of interesting that Baryshnikov appears in this film, White Nights, as a Bolshoi-trained, amazing ballet dancer who is a prize jewel in the crown of Soviet cultural achievement. and defects to the United States. So in many ways, he is kind of playing himself. Not exactly, but it's really close. And the plot of the film is that as he is flying around as a very famous and successful ballet dancer going from performance to performance in the West, on his way to Japan, his plane undergoes some significant engine difficulties and is forced to crash land in the Soviet Union, which is not a good thing for a defector. A Soviet defector is generally tried by some sort of criminal trial in his absence and condemned to various things if he will ever be caught again. And so as his plane is going down, forced to make a crash landing at this military base in the Soviet Union, he's trying to destroy his passport and hope that he won't be recognized and that he's not going to be recaptured and repatriated to the Soviet Union. So that's the setup for the film, which ends up being an escape film. He is, in fact, recognized. He is, in fact, captured by the KGB, and they offer him his old life back if only he will proclaim to the world that he has abandoned the United States, turned his back on capitalism, and run back to the loving arms of Mother Russia and the Soviet Communist Party. And if he doesn't do that, then they don't really get into it. They just imply terrible things. And because he doesn't trust his KGB handlers anymore for some extremely strange reason, they put him under the watchful eye of an American guy, another American dancer, a black tap dancer from Harlem who defected from the United States to Russia. This is a very interesting thing for the Soviets to do, but it's also a very interesting thing for the movie. You have these two defectors cooped up together, and the rest of the movie is kind of a character examination of these two guys as they talk about their lives, they talk about the two countries that they are from, the country that they are trapped in, and then Baryshnikov's character, Nikolai, is trying to convince Gregory Hines' character, this amazing tap dancer, to help him escape to the United States and to come back home with him. That's kind of the whole plot of the movie. And if you are interested in that, go check it out, because it's actually really well made. It's a kind of a bizarre film. It is very unlike Hollywood to make a movie that is this real and this brutal. If you're wanting to watch it, you can hit pause and you can go do that and then come back and listen to the rest. But it's also not a super fun movie. It doesn't have all the fun hijinks that you would expect from some kind of spy caper, and it's not quite as good as, let's say, Great Escape, as escape movies go. It's not a lot of fun, and there's parts of it that are extremely well written, and there's parts of it that are not, so maybe the best thing to do is just listen to the podcast, even though there will be spoilers. Now, speaking of spy movies, there are a bunch of Cold War spy movies that exist. And you'd think that these would be an incredibly good opportunity to talk about the Soviet Union in pretty raw, unflinching terms and to have good guys versus bad guys. But a lot of the Cold War spy films are actually pretty abstract. Spies talk about each other as if it's, you know, so-and-so is just my opposite number. You gotta come in from the cold, but very few spy films actually take moral stances of good versus evil. They talk a lot about the gray area, the similarities between the sides, the murkiness. And I kinda get that. There was a lot of murkiness in that time. But the spy movies oftentimes have just this very vague feel to them. You're not fighting good empire versus evil empire. It is merely spy versus spy. But White Knights doesn't do any of that. It is pretty clear how it's drawing the lines. The good guy is Mikhail Baryshnikov, a guy who turned his back on the Soviet Union so that he could pursue his career in freedom in the United States. And he is gung-ho to escape from the Soviet Union a second time. There's no questioning of what he's going to do or his motivations. As soon as he lands in the Soviet Union, he wants out. And he's identified by a KGB agent right off the bat. This KGB colonel that is kind of running this operation works for the Ministry of Culture and is a pretty cruel and unmerciful guy, even though he is, of course, extending the velvet glove full of rewards for returning to the Soviet Union in good graces. And underneath there is the Iron Fist, if you don't. And the guy playing the KGB colonel is another very interesting guy. His name is Jerzy Skolimowski. He's a Polish filmmaker. He was actually expelled from Poland for making an anti-Stalin film. He's not even an actor, but he does a really good job of portraying this kind of KGB colonel. Someone who is sophisticated, someone who is urbane, someone who has seen Baryshnikov dance both in Russia and in New York, someone who has a fairly deft hand for understanding the cultural implications of this kind of PR and propaganda war between the Soviet Union and the United States, but is utterly merciless when it comes to people's actual lives. He is the case officer and the controller for Gregory Hines' character, who is this tap dancer who has defected to Russia, a guy who is now pretty much useless and forgotten to the party, and so he's way off in Siberia somewhere. And they've still given him what is comparably an incredibly plush life. He's still working as a performer, but he's doing performances for these Siberian miners so that he can be reminded of how brutal the jobs and lives of the proles could be if he doesn't stay in line. And this is where you can see some of this film being really cleverly and well made. This actor, Polish director, does a phenomenal job playing a KGB colonel, probably because of personal experience dealing with communist and Soviet officers. But there's even just a whole bunch of stuff about this character Raymond, formerly of the United States, formerly a Harlem performer, and now currently some kind of Siberian sideshow. A guy who has really convinced himself that he made the right choice to leave America with all of its problems. And he points out in the film some real problems, to come to a place that is just so much worse. But he's pretty self-deluded at the beginning of the film. And the film has to work really hard to make him likable. And it does a phenomenal job. One of the first times that you see him is in this little Siberian village, and he's giving a performance of Porgy and Bess, which is kind of hilarious, but also just perfectly chosen. Because on the one hand, there's nothing weirder and more out of place and this New York tap dancer performing Porgy and Bess in front of this audience of Siberian miners who are just looking at him like they don't care, they don't want to be here, but at least they can sit down. And then the other actors in that play don't want to be there and don't want to be working with him, and the musicians don't want to be there and don't want to be playing this music. But for us, the audience is kind of a brilliant choice because, you know, it's not the greatest musical ever, but at least it is Gershwin. Gershwin's a great composer. And this guy is a phenomenal tap dancer because played by Gregory Hines, and he's a great singer and he's acting, and you can see that he's really a high-level dude, talent-wise. He can kind of be not exactly the equal of Mikhail Baryshnikov, but these are two high-level guys who can respect each other as cultural peers and performers, even if they're on opposite sides of the defection game. And when the KGB colonel puts them both in the same house, which is, you know, bugged and microphoned so that they can be carefully monitored, of course, you get some really good, well-written dialogue. You get to hear some explanation from the black guy explaining why he turned his back on the United States and some of the chips that he still has on his shoulder about it. And it's laid out really carefully and really well and slowly over time so that we as the audience get to know him and like him. And as the movie goes on, the real crux of the movie, again, is not the really tricky escape stuff, carefully planning documents, carefully forging papers. The main thing is these two characters coming to grips with the reality that they are in. And it really is Baryshnikov's character, Nikolai, convincing this black guy, hey, you need to get out of here. You need to get out of this country. I'm leaving, and I want to take you with. And I want to take your wife as well. And at first, Gregory Hines' character is very opposed to this. And we in the audience are extremely sympathetic to Baryshnikov's character, the Russian defector who wants to escape to freedom. And it's frustrating that this guy, whose life is miserable, is hesitant to try to escape. And some of it is pride, but as we learn more about his story, he becomes more sympathetic. It's good filmmaking, even though a lot of the movie is somewhat less fun to watch. The first half of the movie is a lot of fun when they're having these conversations. There's some really good writing there. And what's interesting is these two characters are capable of understanding each other in ways that other people really are not. They and the KGB colonel are pretty much the only three people in the film who have seen both sides of the coin. They have seen capitalist America, and they have seen communist Soviet Union. They are the only three characters who can really understand each other. The colonel is obviously a true believer in the Communist Party. He is not going to change. And then you have Gregory Hines' character named Raymond. He left America because of problems that he saw in America. He believes that he's taking a principled stand, and his pride wants him to stick to that principled stand. And he looks down on Nikolai, the Baryshnikov character, because he believes, hey, you already achieved success. You were one of the most famous Russians to ever live. You were rich, you were famous, you could do whatever you wanted, and you just left because you thought you could get more in America. And Nikolai says, so what if I did leave for selfish reasons? I understand freedom now, and I'm going to escape, and you need to get out of here too. Each of these two men can kind of see past each other's excuses in a way that is interesting. There's a great little bit of dialogue where Raymond introduces his wife, who is Russian, to Baryshnikov and points out the stuff in the house and make yourself at home. Like, yeah, things are pretty nice here. And Baryshnikov is like, oh, yes, you're doing quite well here in Siberia. And Raymond's like, well, yeah, you know, man, but, you know, it's only temporary, you know. And Baryshnikov was like, oh, yes, of course, nobody is here permanently. So these two guys really have a lot of common understanding, and the only thing keeping them apart is pride and just their personal ambitions and desires. And as the film goes on, they get closer together and they become a team. But the other part of the team is Raymond's wife, who is a Russian interpreter who works for the KGB. She was assigned to Raymond when he defected, and she has not experienced a lot of these things. In fact, when they go back to Nikolai's original apartment next to the Kirov Theater, where he used to dance as a young man, and they bring in just the regular food for the ballet dancers, it's stuff that she's never tasted, possibly not even seen before. And the movie just goes out of its way to be very real. In addition to casting people who have hands-on first-party experience with the Soviet Union and the kind of infrastructure and structures that are there for control, they also filmed stuff inside of Leningrad, which is kind of hard to do pre-Glasnost. There's two different stories about this, and I'm not sure which one is true. One is that the director hired a Finnish travel company that had permission to film inside of the Soviet Union to film some stuff for his movie, without telling them that that's what they were doing. And the other story is that this travel company had already shot a documentary inside of Leningrad, and they had this footage that had been smuggled out, and he bought some to use in the film. But either way, this film shows footage of Leningrad and Red Square and real Soviet people on the streets and riding on the buses in a way that Western audiences probably hadn't really seen. It was largely unsanctioned footage that had been snuck out in this extremely unsanctioned movie starring one of the most high-profile defectors the Soviet Union had ever lost. It's like a time capsule of a movie talking about an issue that most movies don't. And there's almost even a nod to how American Hollywood and entertainment is sort of blind to these sorts of things. Nikolai, the ballet dancer, has this New York socialite promoter. And she's on the plane with him that goes down in Russia, and she is taken, of course, to the embassy, because she's an American. And she says, well, he's on the plane with me, so all we have to do is tell the world that he's here, and they will let him go. And the station chief, the CIA guy working at the embassy, is like, oh, no, no, they'll just kill him and say that he succumbed to his wounds. Do not do that. And she is kind of taken aback that this is how the game is played. But over the course of the film, Nikolai and Raymond develop a relationship. They talk. They come up against various threats from the KGB. A new character is introduced, played by Helen Mirren, an old relationship that Nikolai had, who is now running the Bolshoi Ballet, or she's in charge of the performances or something like that. So she is part of the knife that the KGB colonel is twisting in Nikolai's wounds, trying to convince him to come back. Just bow the knee to the Soviet Union and we'll give you your life back. But she is sympathetic to him, sort of. And she agrees to help him just a little bit, but you're not sure if she's fully trustworthy or not. And Raymond becomes sympathetic to Nikolai, but you're not sure if you can really trust him or not. And as they continue to talk, he reveals that not only is it his pride that is getting in the way of recognizing that he made a bad call coming to the Soviet Union. But his family at home hates him, and they blame him for the death of his mother, who was sick and died shortly after he left, and wouldn't even let him talk to her on the phone when he managed to get through on the long distance. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff that make him even more sympathetic to us, despite his position. But finally, when his wife announces to him that she is pregnant, he becomes a much more selfless guy, and he immediately says, "Oh, I'm not letting my kid grow up here. We are getting out." And I guess since we're already talking spoilers, I can let you know he sacrifices himself so that his wife and an unborn child and Nikolai can escape, make it to the American embassy and freedom. But there is still a happy ending. And it's a solid film. Now, parts of it are not super enjoyable to watch. The first half, the two of them are just arguing as they develop their relationship. And the second half is also just them arguing. But the first half is really well-written, insightful arguments. And the second half is really badly written, poorly acted arguments because they are just yelling them into the bugs and the hidden microphones inside of the apartment while they are weaving ropes from unraveled rugs and bending pokers into grappling hooks and stuff like that. But that being said, it's a pretty fascinating film. The problem is that it's a very much of its time movie. This is not going to be a cult classic in the way that some other forgotten films become, because it's just a little strange. You have Mikhail Baryshnikov, one of the greatest dancers of all time, and Gregory Hines, another phenomenal dancer, and so there are these long extended dance scenes that happen, and you kind of have to want to watch those to watch them. And then there is this Soviet angle, which is so culturally irrelevant to this next new generation that it's kind of hard to explain. I showed some clips to my kids, and I had to explain a lot. Now, admittedly, my kids are extremely young, but this idea of defectors, who defectors are, and the value that defectors have for these two governments is something that is pretty different to what we have today. Now, it is true that we have people defecting to and from North Korea now, but it is a totally different thing than what was going on in the 80s. And it's interesting to go over the list of defectors. Number of Russians who defected from the Soviet Union to the United States is very, very high. Number of Americans who defected to the Soviet Union, pretty low, even though there are lots of filmmakers and college professors and directors and actors who went over there for fact-finding missions or appreciation tours. Very few of them actually defect. They all come back to America to talk about how great the Soviet Union was. They never actually want to stay. The most likely people to actually defect to the Soviet Union and go live there are American spies who are spying for the KGB, and they defect right before they are caught. If they think that their number is about up, they run to the Soviet Union and they defect and they say, "I'm only here because it's a superior country with superior living conditions." And I think that's because Soviet Union really only offers a superior living conditions to an American prison. There's a completely different amount of cultural cachet to being that kind of defector. Mikhail Baryshnikov was a big deal because ballet was a big deal, and the Cold War was a big deal. And even when the film came out, I think it did pretty well, but the LA Times reviewed the film as being, "Oh, this is yet another tired anti-Soviet bit of propaganda portraying all Russians as hateful and terrible," which is technically not true because the main character is a Russian, and then Raymond's wife is a Russian, and everybody else is basically a KGB stooge. So portraying KGB stooges who are trying to manipulate people for their own purposes, I think it's okay to have those guys be the bad guys, but not according to the LA Times. So even though the film is incredibly well made, has some phenomenal acting, some great writing, some great directing, the plane crash at the beginning is incredibly well shot. It has this this historic footage of Leningrad that is in basically no other movie made in the West. Yeah, I don't see a resurgence for this film. I don't see it coming back as some kind of cult icon. You pretty much have to be a ballet nerd to want to watch this movie now to see Baryshnikov, and you kind of have to be a Cold War nerd to watch this movie to see the escaping stuff. But let's just ask for a minute, why is that? Because you don't have to be a World War II nerd to think that The Great Escape is a good or interesting movie. World War II is just intrinsic to Western culture in a way that the Cold War isn't, and largely because of cultural institutions like Hollywood. Hollywood has made World War II the great titanic struggle of the 20th century, and possibly of all time, because obviously there's no greater evil than Adolf Hitler and people who are like Adolf Hitler, you know, such as Donald Trump. The tribalism of political thought back in the 80s was such that since Ronald Reagan was opposed to Russia and the Soviet Union and called it the evil empire, they kind of had to say that it wasn't so bad. And all of that baggage from the 1930s, where we pick communism over fascism because those are the only two sides, was still kind of in full force. And that's why White Knights isn't really going to be appreciated by people who are not thinking critically about the Soviet Union and not thinking very culturally about this larger war. It's just kind of not on people's radar. But, you know, maybe that's going to change because this whole fascism versus communism thing is sort of coming back. Not exactly, but fascism versus Russia, that's absolutely coming back. As the war in Ukraine needs stronger and stronger propaganda in order to justify all of the stuff that is going on within the Western world, there is just going to be more and more and more anti-Russia stuff pulled out of the history books and pulled out of old films, just to kind of justify it. People who have been in the past extremely pro-Soviet Union, because anti-fascism, are now extremely pro other people and anti-Russia because Russia. A couple of weeks ago, the Canadian Parliament accidentally gave a standing ovation to a Nazi soldier, actually a member of the SS, because he had been fighting Russia back in the 40s. Now, think real hard about who was fighting Russia back in the 40s. And it's a pretty small list of countries. Also, think back to the 40s. Who was Canada allied with? Well, believe it or not, we were allied with the Soviet Union. So, yeah, that happened. And when Justin Trudeau apologized for it, he kind of admitted that it had happened. He admitted that it was a thing that should not have happened. But then he warned us all to be on our guard because of Russian misinformation. Russian misinformation, by the way, did not cause the Canadian Parliament to invite a member of the SS to come get a standing ovation. This is why it's very important to know your history, especially the kinds of histories that are not important enough to end up in Hollywood blockbuster movies. Not just because there's always going to be some kind of ulterior motive hiding the good history from you, but because it is the forgotten history that is going to be important. You know that old saying, those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. History that is largely forgotten is exactly the stuff that is going to keep coming up. And so history that has been largely forgotten by culture at large is the stuff that you are probably going to see happening again. So you got to know that forgotten history in so that you are well prepared to deal with the stuff that is coming back. So in future episodes, I would like to talk more about Cold War stuff and Hollywood. Since I used to work in filmmaking, it's kind of an interesting topic for me in general, but I think that it's an important topic overall. If you thought it was interesting to hear about why there aren't so many communist movies, we can delve a little deeper into that topic, because there is this whole period of Hollywood in the 50s where you have blacklists, ostensibly, of communist writers. You have the House of Un-American Activities interviewing various studio heads and actors. Ronald Reagan is there. Walt Disney is there. People are being interviewed to find out if there are, in fact, Reds working in Hollywood. It's a good question to ask. It's not like there was a whole lot of evidence one way or the other. And then, of course, there were people who were blacklisted, people, mostly screenwriters, who were blacklisted from Hollywood because they were known communists. And generally, when you see people writing about this today, they put known in quotation marks. But I would rephrase that to be a little more accurate. There were known Communist Party members who had Communist Party membership cards in their wallets that they would show people on a pretty regular basis who were blacklisted from Hollywood temporarily and publicly. And now there are movies made about how great and heroic they were. In fact, we should do a count. It's possible that Hollywood has made more movies about the Hollywood Ten Dalton Trumbo and other people who were blacklisted, lionizing them, than films that demonize actual KGB officers, like White Nights does. So I will dust off some of my old research on that topic, reread a couple of books on that subject, and maybe pull out a future episode. I want to thank you guys for listening to this one, and for all of you who responded. A few weeks ago, I asked, what would you like to hear more of on the podcast? And a lot of you said you would like to be more broad, a wider array of subjects, and even more esoteric than it already was, which is why we just talked about a little-known Cold War film that will continue to be little-known and features a whole lot of tap dancing and ballet in it. Just in case you were curious.